Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects. We have a chance to put some perspective on ourselves as Masons and Masonry generally. It's been an interesting week. We're here together on the 30th of October, 2016. Just seems like yesterday that the Halloween was upon us again. Just seems like yesterday. Tomorrow, Halloween. We see the traditions changing, don't we? A lot more parents are fearful. The days of being able to walk down the street. It's not that the streets were more perilous or less perilous. It was this sense of apprehension. It's growing. There's more today, more tension in the air than ever before, I would say. Apprehension. And so it changes the way that freedom that we experienced as boys walking through the hedgerows and through the woods, unaccompanied, I guess. We would have thought that it would have just changed everything that we do, having adults around, always does. We were free to explore, and explore we did, through every stream and every puddle and up every tree, climb every hill, just to see what was there. And man, did we learn a great deal. We didn't have the urban landscape where I was. It was open fields in the woods. So we learned a lot about, if you were curious at all, to put names to the things around us. We were just simply curious, and we could walk and hike for miles and miles and miles in absolute uninterrupted bliss. Yeah, we knew about the weird men in the neighborhood, but we handled it. Nobody was alone. He was mocked and centered out. He was identified wherever he was. So were they, a couple of them, I guess, over the years. But as far as calling police, I don't think anyone would have thought of it until it was absolutely necessary. And it wasn't necessary just because he was lurking. That was something we could all take care of. And did. But today, things are different. An air of sinister out there. Say hello to people, a stranger in the street, and it's almost a shock for some. I kind of always chuckle to myself when I walk past a couple and say hello to them, and you can tell they don't know what to say. Is he going for my wallet? Is this a shakedown? What does he want? They just don't know what to say. I can't quite decide if that's just small town mentality, because it happens in the big city. You know, people want to look at their boots, no eye contact, be anonymous. And it's changing, but not in the way that people want. It's the way that we're living and we're not holding ourselves accountable. It's not the world around us that's changing, it's us. We become fearful for no other reason than aging. That seems so odd. Young people have always been a young people, essentially making mistakes, doing things that may work out and may not work out. That's never changed. But for us to think that the world is a different place, different attitudes, but attitudes come and go. We're noticing now that all this hovering over children and supervision is having an effect on them. Perhaps not as confident. Perhaps it fuels this sense of obsession to stay connected and communicate at all moments with their friends, their networks. Wealthy and impoverished, doesn't matter. You wonder, of course, is it some clever conversation? When the person slams into me because she was distracted on a cell phone, I hope that was an essential conversation. I hope it wasn't something as trivial as where they're going to meet for a drink after work or some such relatively trivial matter. It's about us. We're the problem in a way, aren't we? Masonry came along with an interesting answer, but I keep trying to figure out what was the question it was answering. That's the cherry on the top of this cake today. A man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? This is the beautiful quote from Robert Browning, and it suggests that to achieve anything, a person should attempt even those things that may turn out to be impossible. Just think, Browning, known as a bit of a poetic genius, wasn't born until 1812, kind of significant year for Canadians. He had so much to offer to the world. But today, we're going to start off with an interesting commentary to follow up on that. A man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? What's the impossible thing that we were striving for through masonry? Becoming a mason. Hindsight would teach us this. I don't know if many new people come into the order having done the calculus. I think it comes afterwards. Reflection. So I'm trying to answer the why of it for us all. And of course, I'm failing miserably at that. I need a little help here. I need a little help. I've got the Remembrance Day coming up, and it presses heavily on my mind, more so each year as I grow a little older. My friend that I know who was in battle, Submariner, very brave at the Suez. Those acts of bravery so often uncharted, and certainly through me, never forgotten. The young father who flew over France in an act of support for the underground, and him and the rest of the crew perished. An act of what I consider necessary heroism. I'm not a fan of war, but those are noble acts to me. and I'll take them to my grave. Memories will never, never die. Here's a little something, though. This is pre-war music. This is music from 1932. This is from, you know, the Nazis did some really remarkable things to try and eliminate very bright people. You know, the land of Copernicus, Poland, the land of mathematics and geometry and philosophy and the arts. And then all of the professors were murdered, all of the intelligentsia were murdered in an effort to try and diminish somehow that that flame. Didn't work. Still rebuilding? Yeah. Will it ever get over it? I don't know if you ever get over something like that. You want to hear a sense of the pace? Browning said, "Who hears music feels his solitude." Here's the music of pre-war Poland. Not exactly withering, is it? A vibrancy, a pace, the heartbeat, energy, confident. That's Poland. That's Polish pre-war music. That's Abdul Bey. It's a remastering by Mikhail Natekis. And well done. Well done. That's not an easy feat at all. We speak about through time, looking through time, knowing that the great moments come and go, and the tragedies come and go, and our memories linger. And you and I have the capacity to rebuild. Back in the 70s, there was a little bit of loose talk about, you know, the pop psychology about reinventing ourselves. Masons reinvent themselves? Constant. I'm convinced more than ever that the strength and the stability of Freemasonry is because it's constantly rebuilding. The appearance is that it is unremarkable and consistent. And it is, because the consistency is in that entrance way. You come through the portal and a new opportunity with a hope, not a guarantee, but with a hope that you are the one that is worthy of all of the exception, all that is being given to you. And you and I look around the lodge and scratch our heads, and we think, there are so many that aren't here amongst us. Shouldn't we have that one-on-one for every one man that we're bringing in? Shouldn't that man be in our lodge? Well, we have to be kind to him. Be kind to them. This is a test of their mettle, a test of their ability. And not everyone is up to that. And that doesn't mean that you can, everybody that participates has that ability. Some participate just because they're so enthralled with the uniqueness of ritual. And who could knock them for that? Who? Of course not. Some just because the importance of not being lonely, making a connection with other men. For some, it's that feeling of importance. Everybody likes to feel important. It's the escape from that the rigor of the mercantile world, where there's this cleansing, this introduction of discussion, where people don't guffaw at you for talking about meaningful things in a man's life. Because we can have conversations within a lodge that doesn't necessarily lead to profit. Remember, it wasn't that long ago when North America particularly and the world was reminded of the value of a liberal arts and science education. Particularly many of the major business schools had stripped away the requirements in MBA programs so that philosophy and ethics was no longer part of the core requirement. A quick analysis of 2008 realized that these cowboys were doing exactly what they were trained to do, unrestrained effort at profit at all costs, at all risk. Without that sense of ethic, what's the right thing to do? The right thing was determined by the work that they did. And the results was a colossal, crashing failure of the capitalist system, redefining. So now the whole process is evolving into something different. The Occupy movement has surfaced, never to be suppressed again. Arab Spring started, and it's not going to go away. There is this thinking that leadership is working at odds with the needs and the well-being of the people. Whether you think that's, you and I think that that's a legitimate question, it is out there. It's out there, and there's evidence, not of rack and ruin, but of evolution, change, the natural organic order of things. We can easily forgive a child who is afraid of the dark, The real tragedy of life is when men are afraid of the light. We are the problem. We are the beginning, the middle, and the end of it. We have no one else to fault, those of us who take responsibility for our lives. We take responsibility. Our achievements are not failures. They are witness to a conviction that to strive for anything worthwhile, we must attempt that which is unreasonable. Otherwise, we limit ourselves to our own lack of self-confidence. We attempt to prove to the world that like-minded men are drawn to the exploration of ideas, are respectful of the damage done by ignorance, and have a desire to at an individual level to not accept the status quo, but to do what one can do to contribute to the greater good. Education for the masses, the Masonic value of greater good resonates. Peace through common understanding, the futility of war. Global brotherhood, rising above differences of race, religion, culture. Masonry. It's what it gives us. Aristotle begins his treatise on metaphysics, which I'm sure you've all just got on your bedstand. So, Aristotle begins his treatise on metaphysics with, don't read it, I'll give you some of the hints here, with the assertion that all human beings have the desire to acquire knowledge. One might think of the political mess going on in the our southern neighbor and question that, but we're polite here. We're Canadian. By this, he means that we value knowledge for its own sake, entirely apart from its utility. Does this perhaps explain why a good Mason would absolutely understand the explorations going on at the Hadron Collider in CERN, Switzerland? Yeah. We're searching for answers. Makes perfect sense. As evidence, Aristotle cites the delight that we take in sense perception, and in particular in vision, the sense that discriminates the largest number of intelligible forms. His teacher, Plato, expressed the delight in vision in a more radical way in the Symposium by attributing it to a demonic force, Eros, which raises human beings up from the world of everyday life to the domain of pure, intelligible structure. For these two great founding fathers of the Western philosophical tradition, one sees a poetical and a sober or prosaic statement of the universality of philosophical love. Agape. Implicit in both statements, but perhaps more clearly in that of Plato, is the claim that we desire not merely knowledge in the sense of a system of true propositions about the world, but a kind of knowledge that satisfies our most fundamental desire for happiness, for blessedness. In the mythical language of the doctrine of Eros, human beings strive for a completeness in the vision of the truth that is the philosophical version of the completeness of sexual love. Otherwise stated, sexual love desires the satisfaction of the body, of which the most radical form is the overcoming of personal finitude through the act of procreation. Whereas the love of the soul can be satisfied only through a vision of the order of the whole of human experience. In short, the Platonic dialogues present us with a poetical account of the philosophical nature of the human being. They also raise the following question. What kind of knowledge is characteristically philosophical? The same question lies at the heart of contemporary philosophy. In the Greek texts, the philosophical appetite seeks to replace opinions with knowledge. For some forms of knowledge are more satisfactory than others. Plato and Aristotle both place general truths higher than particular ones. And they define knowledge in the strict sense as precise and unchangeable. In the contemporary world, the precision and the reliability of mathematics and the experimental sciences seem to make these the definitive types of knowledge, even though it would be difficult to say that such knowledge is unchangeable. Are we then to assume that mathematical and scientific knowledge is philosophical knowledge par excellence? Or in other words, that philosophy is either the same as science or the analysis of the scientific method? This assumption is unsatisfactory because it leaves out reference to human life in any sense other than that of the pursuit of scientific, that is, theoretical, truth. If the love of truth is the desire for completeness or happiness, then a purely scientific conception of philosophy is at odds with human life. For who could honestly claim that scientific knowledge alone is both the necessary and sufficient prerequisite for happiness? Furthermore, if we look a bit more closely at what is meant by scientific knowledge, we find that it cannot be explained purely theoretically, that is, simply by the assertion of true prepositions about the state of things. The propositions in which we describe the state of things, the propositions in which we describe the state of things themselves, depend upon a host of assumptions about scientific procedure, assumptions which cannot themselves be fully verified by the procedure. In other words, science is saturated with philosophy in the form of theories about how to conduct the scientific enterprise, in particular about what things are and how they became accessible to scientific investigation. Still more fundamentally, questions arise as to the extent of the applicability of scientific methods, the use of which we should put scientific knowledge, and even how far we should push our inquiry into the secrets of nature. None of these questions entails the conclusion that science is defective. The questions rather illuminate the difference between science and philosophy, or let us say that they remind us of the many kinds of knowledge and the various sense of true. Such a difference is already visible at the level of the arts and crafts. That is, in any activity generally defined as technical. By this, I mean a methodical procedure, whether simple or complex, that can be taught to others in a step-by-step way, and which is then practiced in accord with rules. A purely technical or objective explanation of any art or science is impossible. The choice of technical materials, their arrangement and exposition of the purposes of the art or science are all an expression of the more general interpretation of the activity in question. In sum, the intrinsic utility of the technique and the intentions of its practitioners are not accessible in a description based upon the mythology of science. Political, ethical, social, aesthetic, and even religious considerations enter into the picture. For that matter, there is not one universal scientific method, but a multiplicity of procedures and assumptions and hypotheses, and so on, all of them chosen on the basis of varying philosophical convictions about the nature of reality. Here's a little reality. This is a street singer. See what you think.
Coucou Mike, il me reste chez Zaz et on va vous faire Je veux avec Ilan Alabou, Ilan Alabou, Ilan Alabou à la basse et Guillaume Gilles à la guitare. Enchanté.
Yeah.
And it ends so abruptly. That's the show. Who is she? French singer on the streets, full of energy. Just a little reminder here that we're not on this planet alone. Then before we forget, if we lull ourselves into believing that everybody should be like us, oh my, wouldn't that be just a train wreck? That there's a diversity around us, a world of absolute delights, a world still emerging, still learning, going over now battles that were fought hundreds and in some cases thousands of years ago and didn't resolve anything, and they're still going on. Approaching the same question with the same insane solution. War will be able to give an answer. The hope is perhaps like the end of the Hundred Years' War, where everybody is just beaten to a standstill, you can kill, we can kill, we'll sacrifice more, you'll sacrifice more. But after 100 years, it became pointless. It became pointless. Always read the small print. Things are revealed when the thought behind them is clear and true. Those who promise revelations always seem to be holding something back. Usually, it's ignorance. There appear to be three types of books published on Freemasonry. First, those that cater for lodge members, ritual books, inspiring books about Masonic history, any number of works on Masonic medals, costume and memorabilia. Second, books that use elements of Masonic lore to weave speculative stories. Fantastic stories. Remember, we had a lot of fabricating going on in the early histories. But it's fascinating. Oh, you repeat it long enough and somebody begins to believe that it's true, which has left the historians rubbing their little hands happily in 2016, still able to cause revelations to us. Did you know that that guy was a charlatan? Did you know that a lot of that stuff was made up? Well, now we do. And did we know that we created a history, manufactured it, because we needed a history and we couldn't figure it out? But we needed one, so we made one. So fault us for being inventive. Second are those, the books about the lore, the speculation, lots of sensationalism. Fun to read, Morgan, you know, Blackfriars, wonderful mysteries. Fun to read. They tend to obscure more valid stories behind them. You know, the fiasco that led to Masonry losing its favor in North America, in the United States. The fiasco, the apparent arrogance. The blatant arrogance that was intolerable in the New World. On the whole, the road of access leads to the palace of confusion. I love that line. The road of access leads to the palace of confusion. And it was a we indulged. On the whole, books written for practicing Freemasons tend to play down symbolism, spirituality, and esoteric content. The stress is usually on cementing community and relationships. In speculative books, however, the typical Masonic experience, turning up for monthly meetings and raising funds for charity, seems to get lost altogether. Such is the barrage of half-baked pseudo-mystical titillation and conspiracy theory. The revelations fail to satisfy the curiosity evoked. There is no revelation, only the hints of one. These two classes of books are flatly opposed by a third class, purported to reveal the truth behind Freemasonry. Have you got your armrests firmly gripped here, gentlemen? Or a fist tightly clasped around your glass of favorite beverage to reveal the truth? These books are usually hostile to the craft. Authors of these books tend to be influenced by the climate of conspiracy of the second class. But find in the mythical confusion nothing but dark intentions. It is not unknown for hostile authors, those who suppose Freemasons to be involved in immoral activities of covert influence and control, to be forced to invent a kind of superclass of men in black, gnomes of Zurich, eminences, grises, to explain the obvious innocence and ordinariness of Freemasons. The first known exposure of the craft derives from religious fanaticism of the late 17th century. You might think there was nothing left to expose. Hostile exposures have been enormously influential. They have given Freemasonry the reputation of being a secret society. Secrets are taken to be synonymous with conspiracy. We all have secrets. Are we all conspirators? It is not unknown to hear that the 3 degrees of Freemasonry are perfectly okay, if you like that sort of thing. But the dodgy stuff can be found among members of higher degrees. These degrees, Knights Templar, Rose Quarrel, and so on, attract interest as a result, though not, I observe, huge influxes of new recruits who actually want to experience the real thing. We like our fictions, but they do tend to color our perception of everyday life. When a thing is magnified, its true proportion is distorted. Monsters are portrayed like medieval devils or hideously deformed people until the microscope gave us magnified images of spiders and beetles and microorganisms. Cinema completed the process by magnifying the innocent and natural into the scary and supernatural. The invasion of the giant spiders. Magnification is a benefit to science, but when applied to popular culture, it changes our sense of the real. Freemasonry has been magnified. It is persistently presented outside of its true proportions. To be sure, you will find more secrecy in the workings of elected governments, often with very serious implications for life, limb, and pocket, than you will ever find in the running of Masonic fraternities. You get the idea. Given the extent of so much disinformation and bad information, it's worthwhile to attempt an open book on the reality of Freemasonry. Been a valuable experience. It came out of lecturing at Exeter University's Department of Humanities and Social Science, the product of scholars. There are many reasons there's a lack of a standard work, not the least of which is the fact that Masons have themselves long been unable to satisfy questions put to them on any number of aspects of the craft. And if they cannot give you the answers, who can? In Germany under Hitler, the Nazi high command decided that Freemasons were all part of that Jewish Masonic conspiracy to dominate the world. And fascists who were not slow to in publishing this propaganda wherever they could, especially in the Middle East, which still suffers from its effects. Everyone who wants to take over the world will tell you they're only trying to save you from a fate worse than them. Nevertheless, in spite of being so absolutely certain of their imagined conspiracy, the Nazi SS still had to commission a serious study of the subject because it lacked hard information. Like so many bad historians. First, they had the theory, then they looked for the evidence to try and back it up. And across the English Channel, in our own time, an MP, Chris Mullen, launched a Common Select Committee investigation of Freemasonry in Britain to coincide with Tony Blair's ascension to power in 1997. Grand Secretary Michael Higgins' ascension to videotaped interrogation by members of the committee stimulated some observers to write to the papers comparing the outrageous scenes with the anti-communist excesses in the House Un-American Activities Committee during the McCarthyite era. When asked by journalist Doug Pickford what his chief source of information on Freemasonry was, Chris Mullen, MP, cited Martin Short's undeniably hostile expose inside the Brotherhood. Whatever else it merits, Short's book was not an objective academic study. It is often said that truth is stranger than fiction. We can try to aim at the truth, but sometimes the evidence is difficult to understand or to interpret definitively. Facts alone may tell us very little. They do not stand in isolation. Motives are seldom easy to ascertain. We rarely have the facility of forensic evidence, and to be sure, we do not always need it. After all, we are not attempting to nail a conviction before the evidence goes cold. Most of the evidence for or against Freemasonry went cold a very, very long time ago. And we cannot, with the best will in the world, revivify corpses. Nor can a book hope to include every fact or detail of the subject that some readers might want or expect to find. But it is possible, with enough research, to acquit Freemasonry of all crimes against either truth or prejudice. Enough. Here's a little something to put us into a more global perspective again. Hope you like Dave Brubeck. This is his version of Stardust. wraps up another show. Thank you for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you here. We're only 51 days and 21 hours until winter begins. 51 days and 21 hours. Oh, don't get your panties in a wad. Winter only lasts 88 days. 88 days, 23 hours, and 45 minutes. You want to know? 88 days of winter. That's it. 51 days, we're coming up to the shortest day of the year. Winter solstice. December 21st this year. So about a quarter to six in the morning. Yeah. That'll mark the beginning of winter. So much to enjoy. It's all very quick, and the alternative is always permanent. Enjoy each other's company, gentlemen. Be sure to commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And may the lodge, the Masonic lodge in your heart and mind, be the greatest, most welcoming and interesting place in the world. Let's see you next week. Put you in the mood. See you soon. Come on back.
Coucou Nike in Noise, c'est Zaz et on va vous faire Je veux avec Ilan à la boue, Ilan à la boue, Ilan à la basse et Jim Jelle à la guitare. Enchanté.
Bye.